Greetings all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. We are today in lesson 185. And in the last lesson, we were in Genesis chapter 32 and verse 13, 14. At this point, Jacob is praying to God after he hears of Esau coming against him. And obviously, when a man comes with 400 men with him, that's an army. There's only one intent there behind it. And Jacob fully understood that. And at this point, Esau still has an intent to, he comes here, in other words, against his brother with the intent of harm and not good. And so God obviously interferes in between, and between the time that Esau departed, hearing about his brother coming over there, remembering all that he had done to him, 20 years did not dull, you know, his senses and his anger at what his brother had done to him, and where he is now because of that, you know, he began to realize at that point and after that the enormity of the birthright and what he had done himself. And of course he did not consider his own actions, but he thought only in terms of what Jacob had done to him. Oftentimes that's the way human beings are in their carnality. They forgot what they have done, and we always, generally speaking, being human beings, listening to our own carnality, we always look at what the other person had done to us, and we never think about what we have done, our responsibility. That's generally the nature of a carnal mind. And the converted mind will think, okay, that's what he'd done, that's what I've done, you know, let's sit down and compromise, you know, we're both guilty, and let's make peace. Well, Esau did not have this intention of making peace with his brother Jacob. He was going to take vengeance on him. And obviously, God, just like with Laban, made sure that this does not happen. And so at this point, as Jacob is addressing God, in verse 10, as we read earlier, let's read that again for sake of continuity. Jacob is saying in verse 10, O God of my father Abraham, the God of my father Isaac, O Eternal, that is Jehovah, you who say to me, return unto your country and to your kindred, and I will do you good. Now what was happening here on the part of Esau is not good. And so he's bringing that to the attention of God, and not with the attitude that his children had when Moses brought them out of Egypt. Every time they had a problem, even though God already told them that he's going to bring them to the good land, he's going to be with them and bless them, he proved it to them, he performed all the signs and wonders. Instead of just bringing it to the attention of God, just like here, as their father Jacob prayed, they started complaining and griping and even blaming God for seeking their hurt. That's the difference between the carnal mind and the converted mind. You know, when we are in trouble, we don't point the finger at God and accuse him. When we are sick and afflicted, when somebody in our family dies, you see, when we are in trouble, and we think, well, we've served God, we've done good, and how come we're in trouble? How come we're not being promoted? How come this and how come that? You know, how come Johnny died, people say? Why would they even ask this kind of questions? They do it because in their own mind, even though they don't like to admit it, they feel that God has done something wrong. You know, he's not right. That's the reason why Johnny died. You see, we do not consider all matters, and we do not come before God with humbleness and meekness and humility, and, you know, as Job said, you know, everything was taken away from me, but, you know, let's remember, God gave it to begin with. What am I to complain about? And God took it. That's his. See, we don't think like that. And then he said, yeah, let the name of God be blessed. And so, well, you know, this is another opportunity for us to learn lesson here from the law. But when we come before God, you know, as Jesus Christ told us later, you know, this very God that Jacob is praying to him, first, you acknowledge God and his kingdom and his glory and his government and his intent, you know, for all mankind and his purpose and destiny. And you thank him for him, you thank him for what we have. And if he chooses to take it away from us, we thank him for that too, because, you know, it'll be for our own good ultimately. You see? And when we do it, well, obviously God listens. And God was listening to Jacob. And the future will come, as God said about his own people, before you call, I will answer, because when Jacob calls now, it's not going to be like the old Jacob, you know, the people of Israel, constantly griping and complaining when they call upon God. No, no, they are going to be converted and the Spirit of God is going to be in them. Well, Jacob is at this point already that many of us are still going to have to reach in the future if we don't have that attitude now. And so he's reminding God about what he told him, and he comes to him with absolute faith. As God said later on, without faith, you cannot please God. You know, you read it in Hebrews, chapter of faith. And so he has complete faith in God. He does what he has to do, and we must do what we can do, humanly speaking, but ultimately we know that only God can deliver us. And so once he had done what he could do, in other words, dividing his everything that he had into two to make sure that, you know, if worse come to worse, at least one part would survive. But obviously he's not interested in anything, and any hurt coming upon him, so he's calling upon God, and that's what he's saying here. You know, you promised that to me, and I trust in you. And then he even goes beyond that, and sometimes we forget that. We just think that he owes it to us. You know, your children are like that. You know, they're sick and hurt and all that. They get angry at their father or their mother or somebody, you know, when they don't help them. Well, he's saying, you know, in verse 11, something we should remember and learn and internalize before a problem comes. I'm not worthy of all of your mercies. You see? And we don't come to God demanding. You know, we should remember who gave it all. We don't deserve any. And so that's what he's saying here, you know. And he's not just playing games here. That's the way he feels. Realizing what he really is and what he had done in the mercy and grace of God. There aren't many people who really appreciate the grace of God, and so when a problem strikes, the first thing they do is griping against God, and there are unfortunately too many in our midst with a gripe against God. He says, I'm not even worthy of all your mercies and of all the truth. See, the mercies and the truth that he had revealed to him. You know, he's been working with him all this time, 20 years. So he said, I'm not worthy of that, of all the truth, which you have shown unto your servant. And he's not explaining here exactly what that truth that he's talking about, but you can imagine an awful lot of communication was there between him and God, and learn, you know, lessons that were learned and truth that was available to him that he became aware of, communication from the mind of God to his mind. That's what he's saying. I'm not worthy of any of that. Many of us have so much and we're not even appreciative of that as we should. And so that's what he's saying here. For with my stuff I pass over this Jordan, and now I am become toucans. You know, that's the reason why he called the place Mahanaim. Mahanaim, the Aim in Hebrew signifies double. You see, the Im is generally the plural. Like El, Elohim, or Eloha, Elohim. El, Elim. The Im generally signifies the plural in Hebrew. But Aim, like eyes, there are two. Like legs, there are two. Like hands, there are two. You use the Aim, and so he called it Mahanaim. And so I said, this is what I've become now. Two camps. So many, so much. And he said, I'm not worthy of any of that. And so he prays to God, and he pleads with him, deliver me, I pray you, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau. For I fear him, lest he come and smite me, the mother, with the children. And you said, he's reminding God, I will surely do you good, and make your seed as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. Well, obviously, for that to happen, and he has the faith, and he knows that, he cannot have destruction within his family. And so, verse 14, now we read, you know, he prays to God, and so he has complete faith in him, and he knows God will hear, and there will be deliverance. And so, in verse 14, we read, and he lodged there that night, that is, before he crossed that ford or stream. It's not really a river in the terms of rivers in this country, you know, just a small stream and not too impressive. And then during the rainy season, this is when it fills up, and then it looks a little bit more like a river. And so he said he lodges there, during the night, and it says, and he took of that which he had with him a present for Esau his brother, trying to pacify him, 200 she-goats and 20 he-goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams. You can imagine, he had an awful lot. You know, if he can give a gift, 200 she-goats and rams, so, and more of other things, well, obviously, he's been abundantly blessed by God. And he knew that it came from God, so he was first acknowledging the greatness of God, his mercy and love, and then he's making his request. You know, we just yell at God, you know, help. You know, you owe it to us. You know, if you don't, we get angry. And so he offers him all that in verse 16, 30 milch camels and their colts, 40 kine and 10 bulls. That's an awful lot of possession just to give as a gift. And the custom of the Middle East is that if you accept someone's present, then obviously you can never, ever do harm to that person, because honor is extremely important in that society, and everybody would know that you received a gift and yet you turn around and cause somebody harm, and your honor will be gone. And so if you could get somebody to take your present, then you are assured that he's going to treat you well for the rest of his life. And that's in essence what he was trying to do here also. And so in verse 17 we read, and he delivered them into the hand of his servants, every drove by itself, in other words the cattle by itself and the goats by themselves and the camels, and he in a shrewd manner, in a wise manner, yet in a harmless manner, he makes sure that Esau sees one group after the other, you know, and you see more and more and more and more, and then you find out it's all for you, you know. By that time you forgot where you came from, what you came for, you know, and you forget your anger. So in essence he was trying to do humanly possible what he could, but really ultimately relying on God to change the attitude of Esau, not just through his gift, which in essence is sort of a bribe, but directly by the Spirit of God to alter the attitude of Esau and to remove the anger, you know, from his heart. And so this is what he does here, and he tells his servants, pass over before me, in other words, cross that stream, and put a space between drove and drove. You see, you know, all that is deliberately planned, so that as Esau sees one group, and then he sees another one, then he sees another one, then he finds out it's all for him, well, by then, well, what can you do? Verse 18, and he commanded the foremost, saying, when Esau, my brother, meets you, and asks you, saying, whose are you? In other words, whose servant are you? Where did you come from? All those things that you bring with you, what are they for? And so when he asks you, whose are you, and where are you going? That is, why there goest thou? That's old English language. And it takes an awful lot from the continuity of the thought, because it's awkward. But I guess in the old days, that was natural, normal language for them. So today we think differently. Anyway, I'll paraphrase it, because that old English language is a hindrance, in essence, for modern days to convey thought. And so he's asking him, where do you come from? And where are you from? Where are you going? And whose are these before you? In other words, all the stuff that you have with you, all the animals, all these gifts. Then you shall say, they are your servant Jacob's. You see, not your brother. See, your servant. So he's in essence magnifying the position of Esau in contrast to him. And when you want to come before somebody who is mightier than you, you better be humble. There are many people who are arrogant, you know, as mentioned before, you know, you just think I'm just as good as you are. And that's how conflicts are created. And instead of a person, as mighty as he may be, still humbling himself before another person, then creating the atmosphere of peace. We oftentimes do not use this kind of wisdom. This is the biblical wisdom, the wisdom that comes from above. You know, in contrast, as James would say, you know, the wisdom from beneath is devilish. Why is it? Because it's confrontational oftentimes. You know, it seeks its own. It's arrogant, you know, just, whom do you think you are? I'm just as good as you are, you know. This is not from God. So he's using a divine wisdom here in order to gain the heart of his brother. And he commended, and that's what he says to them, you know, every single one of you should do the same and say the same. That's from your servant, Jacob. So, you say, they are from your servant, Jacob, and it is a present sent unto my Lord. You see? Esau keeps hearing it from every single one of them. Well, you see, it makes you feel awkward about being belligerent against a person, you know, who humbles himself before you, calls himself your servant, and calls you Lord, and gives you all those gifts. So he was going to make it as difficult as possible for him to be belligerent against him. And that's what he's saying here. So it is, you know, present unto my Lord, even unto Esau. So he's not even addressing in the first person, but second person, which basically denotes honor and respect. And behold, he also is behind us. And he commanded also the second and the third and all that followed the droves, saying, in this manner shall you speak unto Esau when you find him. And he shall say, moreover, behold, your servant, Jacob. You're going to see this terminology here. Your servant, and, you know, in contrast to you, Lord, an awful lot here. And that is a part of wisdom. That's what the proverb says, you know, a soft answer turns away wrath, you know, but if you come and you speak arrogantly, obviously you're going to create more wrath instead of peace. And that's exactly what Jesus Christ was saying. Blessed are the peacemakers, you see. This is a classic example here, how to be a peacemaker. That even if you are right, and you enter into an argument, and you deal with another person or some other persons, you know, you don't come and put them down and tell them they're wrong and you're right. You know, you humble yourself and you acknowledge that, you know, maybe you've done something wrong and, you know, let's sit together and in peace, you know, solve this matter. And that, in essence, mollifies their anger, you know. They feel uncomfortable after that. And they, in essence, even turn around and say, oh, well, I guess we were wrong too. And that's how you solve the matter. That's what it means. Peacemaker, not war maker. Esau was a war man, Jacob was a peaceman. And that's in essence what also God was looking for in Jacob. Lessons that he should have learned. Not to be deceitful, not to be arrogant, not to be a war man, but to be peaceful, to walk in the ways of peace, in the ways of truth. And people like that, as God says, God is going to resist the proud, but he's going to give grace to the humble. I mean, Jacob was totally humbling himself here before his own brother. And certainly God was going to give him grace, and he did. And so that's what he's saying, you know, even tell him even more so. And he shall say, moreover, behold, that is, you shall say to him, your servant, not your brother, you know, as good as you are, but your servant, Jacob, is behind you. And mind you, you know, they're the same age. You know, they were born at the same time. They're twin brothers, but just a matter of few seconds. And yet the office of the birthright here was being magnified by Jacob, that the older brother becomes in essence sort of the master and the younger brother is in essence a servitor to him, when the reality was just the other way around from God's point of view. But that's what he presents it, and that's godly. And so that's what he's saying here. You say to him, moreover, behold, your servant Jacob is behind us, for he said, I will appease him with the present that goes before him, before me, and afterward I will see his face. Peradventure he will accept me. So you see, you know, the ultimate concept here in the sense that Christ was saying, you know, you've got to be shrewd as a serpent and harmless as a dog. And Jacob is fully internalizing this this understanding here and expressing it. A good lesson for all of us, and we certainly will get much more ahead if we function in this manner, with this divine wisdom instead of the human wisdom. And so, we're in verse 22, so the present passed over before him, that is Esau, and he himself lodged that night in the That is, well, it passed before him, speaking about Jacob, that is, so. In other words, he sent them forward toward Esau, while he stayed behind. In verse 23, and he rose that night and took his two wives and his two handmaids. And it doesn't mean here that the first two were wives and the others were not. All it means is that the positions, you know, the social position in which they are according to the system of the time was that the wife has a preeminence, so she's called the wife. The other one is called the concubine. But that does not mean non-wife. It just means that she's on a secondary level. And so that's the reason why they would constantly be reminded of this point, that they are handmaids, they are concubines, they're second rate. You know, nowadays we think it's strange and weird, but, you know, had we lived at that time, we would have taken it for granted and our attitude would have been different. So in order to really appreciate and comprehend whatever you're reading, you have to put yourself in the shoes of those people and not judge them from our point of view. Then we'll have a proper comprehension of what we are reading and the circumstances of the time. And so that's the way God had recorded it. That's the way he made Moses, you know, Moses write it. And so let's see it from his point of view. And so he took his two wives and his two handmaids and his 11 children. And Benjamin was not born yet. He came later on. And mind you, he doesn't say 12 children here, because he actually had 12 at this point, including Dinah. You see? But the biblical terminology generally basically uses the boys in terms of counting, and generally they don't count the girls. And it's understandable when women nowadays, with all the hurt and abuses and all that, will look at this one and say, what a chauvinism. Well, let's look at it from God's point of view, the way things were done and the reasons for it. And God is not a chauvinist, and therefore, you know, we should not look at the Bible or read it from that point of view. We too can, you know, humble ourselves, if we happen to be, that is, those who are women, before God and accept his will and the manner in which he had chosen to write whatever or deal with his children, whatever way he did. And so he took his 11 children and passed over the ford of the Yabbok, or Jabbok. That's something beyond me. Why the English needed to change the Yo, you know, the Y or the E sound into J. So everything becomes a J, like instead of Yerushalayim, it becomes Jerusalem. Instead of Yehovah, they say Jehovah. Instead of Yehovah Yireh, they say, you know, Jehovah Jireh, you know, which is sort of mocking the language without even really intending to do it. Anyway, whatever the reasons, I don't know. So I wouldn't judge them. It just sounds very strange when you speak Hebrew and that's your language, and then you see how every single name and place has been changed because of the different letters that they use there. Verse 24, and he took them and sent them over the stream and sent over that which he had. And so now he sends all the rest forward while he himself remains there just by himself. And obviously, he had a reason for doing it. He was going to spend a lot of time wrestling with God in prayer. And instead of that, he wrestled literally with God. So we read in verse 25, and Jacob was left alone, and there wrestled a man. You see, and that's the way God is recording it to Moses. You know, right? A man. He could have said, you know, wrestled with an angel or wrestled with God. And a man, some people don't realize that, is another name of God. And when he came in the flesh, that's the way he called himself, the Son of Man. So he did not even address himself by his own name. He said, the Son of Man. And as you can read in the Song of Moses, that's what God has inspired Moses to say, the Lord, Jehovah, is a man of war. You see, when it comes to deliver his people. Because he created us in his image and in his likeness. And if we are like him, he's like us. So that's another title that he gives himself, a man. And so that in essence signifies the future of man. If God is man, then man is God. And some people obviously read over that and they don't understand, they don't comprehend the inner meaning of this statement here. And so he wrestled with the man with him until the breaking of the day. And when he saw that he prevailed not against him, he touched the hollow, that is the man, that is God, that is the angel. He touched the hollow of his thigh, and the hollow of Jacob's thigh was strained. And so you can imagine that all night. You know, it's an awesome sight when you think about it. You know, here is God in person, in the flesh, coming and wrestling with Jacob, with man, with any single one of us. You know, if you want to think about it from that point of view, he's wrestling with us on our own level, in essence. He doesn't come as a supreme being there, you know, otherwise there wouldn't be any match there. But he comes on our own level and he wrestles with us. And there is an intent for it, you know. It's just not a senseless action that is happening here. There are an awful lot of lessons that are being taught here. An awful lot of lessons that we can learn from the mind, you know, about the mind of God. And how he deals with us, and how he loves us, and how he cares about us, and how he wants us to wrestle with him. You know, not gripe at him, not scream at him, not yell at him, not be angry at him. Wrestle with him through whatever situation we go through. Wrestle in prayer. You know, Moses had done that. Abraham had done that. Jacob has done that. You know, all the fathers have done that. They've given us many lessons. You know, David had done that. You know, he constantly wrestled with God, you know, in his psalms. And so we wrestle with him in prayer and everything. And he comes down to our level, so to speak. So we know that, you know, he can communicate and we can communicate with him and he understands us. He knows what we are going through. And so that's what is happening here. And many other lessons that we can learn from it. You know, we don't have enough time to discuss everything, obviously. And there is much more we may not even be aware of. And so in verse 27 we read, and he said, let me go. That is the one wrestling with Jacob. Let me go, for the day breaks. And a lot of people obviously think about it and try to understand what is really happening here. And they have many thoughts. God appears to man in the visions of the night. And then when the morning comes, he departs. And so, you know, many lessons are injected into that when you consider many of these aspects of the way God appears to man, generally speaking. It doesn't mean that it doesn't appear during the day, but oftentimes much of his appearances to men come in dreams, in visions at night. And when the daybreak comes, it's over. And so that's what he's saying here, you know, let me go, for the day breaks. And he said, I will not let you go, except you bless me. Now, obviously, Jacob is fully aware that he's not dealing just with an ordinary man. You see, that by itself would have been strange. You know, you stay there behind him, you wrestle all night with a man. Obviously, you know, the scripture here does not choose to tell us the whole background, the context, what is really happening here. What are they saying during all this night of wrestling? You see, had you been there, you would have seen an awful lot. That is not recorded here at all. But if you place yourself in that position, when you're in trouble, when you have a crisis ahead of you, and as many leaders have learned in time past, that, you know, leaders that knew God, knew about God, and even people who did not know God, they would spend quite a bit of time right before making a very, very ominous decision, an important decision, just sort of wrestling with the problem before they make a decision. And the men of God, you know, they would, in essence, you know, they spend a lot of time before a major crisis and decision in wrestling with God, in prayer. And here it is, literally, he was wrestling to him, in praying to him directly, that is, in speaking to him, that's what prayer is all about, and literally wrestling with him in person. So that's, in essence, the ultimate sense of wrestling with God here that Jacob was experiencing. And so much was happening as that was, you can, you know, imagine if you were going through it yourself. And so he says to him, I wouldn't let you go until you bless me. Now, what is he asking? You see, why is he asking that? We need to ask a lot of questions and then meditate and ponder, and whatever the Spirit of God, you know, leads us to understand, that's our riches. And verse 28, and he said to him, what is your name? See, he's not blessing him at this point. He's just asking him first, what is your name? Now, he doesn't know his name. Of course he knows his name. Jacob knows who that person is, who that being is. Therefore, he's asking him for blessing. So, in other words, what you read is not what it really says. And oftentimes, a lot of people read the Bible and say, well, I know what it says. And then it doesn't dawn on them, yeah, of course, you may know what it says, but do you know what it means? Do you know what's really behind it? You see, only the Spirit of God can open our eyes to see what we are reading. And most people are not in this category. And so he's asking him, what is your name? And he's going to make a point here. And he said, Jacob. And he said, your name shall be called no more Jacob. Yaakov, supplanter. You see, supplanter means, you know, he that prevails over his opponent by deceit. So see what's the nature of the wrestling here. The ultimate wrestling is with God and with our own selves, our own nature. You see, we have to wrestle with ourselves to control ourselves, to remove that which is not of God in us. And that's in essence what God was forcing him in this sense of wrestling with him, to come to recognize himself for what he is and to depart from that. And then, you know, in other words, through the conversion and repentance that God grants, our hearts are changed and we are no longer what we used to be. You know, then the old man dies. And, you know, as Paul would put it in other words, you know, they who drink, they drink in the night. You know, they who do whatever they do in the night. But you see, when the daybreak comes, you know, he's in essence referring to this very event here and this concept, you know. The night is for wrestling, but the day, you know, is for the victory. And the works of the night should be left behind. And now the works of the day should be righteousness. So Jacob is attending through this experience, which is the experience of his life. The whole process of conversion is compressed here into this very night of wrestling directly with God all night. And so this is what God is telling him. The one that is introduced as a man, in other places introduced as an angel. And he said, yeah, you know, he's asking, what is your name? And he said, Jacob. And he said, that is God is speaking, your name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel, or Israel in Hebrew. In other words, he that prevails with God, or some would say, a champion of God, one that conquers and contends, you know, for the divine, and he's conquering by strength from above. You see, with the strength that came from above, from God, he's able to contend with God, to wrestle with God. And God gives us the strength, you know, to wrestle with him. And this is what he's saying, your name shall be Israel. But you see, this is a process, you know, we are reading it as a story. A lot of people are just reading it as an old-time story, you know, a sweet lullaby to tell little children at night, or in Sunday school, whatever it may be. And they don't realize this is the very thing that every single one of us must go through. We're not going to have this, you know, exact experience that Jacob had, where God in person will come down and wrestle with us. And it's not always necessary. We're going to have to do it on a daily basis through every single trial and every thought that goes through our mind, courses, you know, and traverses our minds and wants to lead us in the wrong direction. We're going to have to, you know, subjugate that. You know, as Paul would say that, you're pulling down, you know, all those strongholds and all towers, you know, that resist God, and bringing every thought into captivity to Jesus Christ. And that's, in essence, what Jacob was doing here in wrestling. And then only when we do it and we come to the point with the help of God where we overcome that, then our name also changes to Israel. He that prevails, wrestles with God and prevails with the strength of God given to us to begin with to be able to do it. And that's what he's saying here, your name shall be Israel, for you have striven with God. You see? What happens with God? Well, God is the one that was striving with him, wrestling with him, and with men. And the man, you know, was Laban and many others to come, including himself. And he said, you've done that, and you have prevailed. And that's what God says when he came in the flesh. He used these very words. He that endures until the end, he that wrestles with God and man until the end, and with demons and with the devil, you know, resisting him, he shall prevail. And his name at that point will be Israel. You see, presently, physically, many of us are Israelites, but in the real sense of the name, we're anything but Israelites. You see, and many of us have been grafted into Israel, and it's a process. You see? That only at the end time we would really earn this title, Israel, he that contends with God and prevails. The victory will come at the end. Now we're still going through the night. At daybreak, if we endure until the end, God will change our name and give us a new name, as he said, we read in Revelation, a name that will be known to us only, not to others. And we'll find out exactly what it means when that happens. In verse 3, and Jacob asked him and said, tell me, I pray you, your name. Now, why is he asking for his name? As if when you have a background and context, you know, and look at other examples, you begin to understand what is really happening here. What does it mean to ask for his name? And with whom was he wrestling to begin with? You see, you put all those things together, and you have a greater understanding, and, you know, maybe you can spend a little time on that now and give you a little bit more application, that is, amplification of this matter. Now, when we go to Hosea, for example, we read later on about this very event in chapter 12. You see, the children of Israel who wrestled with God, who overcame, contended with God, with the help of God and strength, and endured until the end, his name was changed to Israel. But in contrast, his children, instead of doing that and following the footsteps of their father, Jacob, you see, so God can know them by name, you see, so they can know God by name, they did not do it. They went astray. And so here in Hosea, we have a specific an issue here that God is presenting before his people, in specific here, Ephraim. When he says Ephraim, he basically speaks about the entirety of the 10 tribes of Israel. But, you know, Israel, Ephraim was at the head, just like when he speaks about the kingdom of Judah. You know, Judah was the head of that kingdom, which was made of Benjamin also and Levi, and whatever sprinklings of the tribes of Israel that joined them. So when you read Ephraim, some people, you know, think, aha, Ephraim means, you know, the British people. No, he's not talking about the British people. He's talking about the 10 tribes of Israel. Ephraim, you know, is the name that is used for the 10 tribes. So even many of us are not properly reading this scripture as we should, and therefore do not fully comprehend what we are reading and the consequences of what it means in terms of prophecy and all the things that will happen not only to the single tribe of Ephraim, but to all the 10 tribe nation of Israel that obviously today is many nations. And so in chapter 12 we read in verse 1, Ephraim feeds on the wind. In other words, you know, this is not where life is lived, you know, just living on the wind, you know. Because the wind comes, the wind goes, and you've got nothing left in your hand. That's what he's saying here. You know, there's no substance to his way of life. It comes and goes, you know, it's meaningless. And so that's what he's saying here. You know, he feeds on the wind and pursues the east wind. Now, what was the east wind? You know, from the east generally came the hot winds that dried everything. You see, and so all the green became dry. So, again, you know, it's not something that is worth going after. And it says this is what he's pursuing, you know. Something that will leave him dry at the end, and he's still going to be empty. And so he says, that's what Ephraim is. And mind you, you know, in the context, we're reading it in contrast to his father Jacob. You see? And so he says, he daily increases lies and desolation. Also, they make a covenant with the Assyrians, and oil is carried from Egypt. And, you know, there's a lot of background here, but I wouldn't go necessarily through it now. And so in verse 2 we read, the Lord also brings a charge against Judah. So he's speaking about both Judah and Ephraim. And Ephraim means the head of the 10 tribes. That means he's speaking about the 10 tribes, the whole nation of Israel at the time. And to this very day, wherever they are, all around the earth, be it in the Americas or England or the Northwest Europe or South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, whatever, he's speaking about all of them. And here in particular, in the days of Hosea, you know, Ephraim, you know, the head of the tribe of Israel, was still there. And so, we read here also in verse 2, the Lord also will bring charge against Judah and will punish Jacob. Now, Jacob is now the entirety of both Ephraim and Judah. All the houses of Israel, the two of them. The northern and the southern. And so he says, he will punish Jacob according to his ways. According to his deeds, he will recompense him. For he took his brother by the heel. Now, speaking specific about their patriarch, Jacob. He says he took his brother by the heel in the womb. And in his strength, he struggled with God. You see, with Elohim. So he's telling you who that personage was that he was struggling with. So he's contrasting, in essence, Jacob, the patriarch, the way he was, and the way he became, you see, while in contrast, his own children are not going in his footsteps, you see. So this is the contrast he's making here. So in his strength, he struggled with God. Yes, he struggled with the angel and prevailed. And he's making it very plain. The man, the angel, God, Elohim, they're all the same. See, just referring to himself in essence. And the one who is speaking here in essence through Hosea is the one that was there. So he calls himself man, angel, God. And people who, you know, do not have much knowledge and understanding, and many, you know, unfortunately, too many in our midst are losing that understanding. They've lost their capacity to comprehend and understand, because the Spirit is departing from many. Those who are departing from the Spirit of God, from God Himself. And so that's what he's saying here very plainly. This is what Jacob was. He struggled with God. You know, yes, you know, he was a supplanter. He was a deceitful manner. You know, he took his brother by the heel and he lived all that 70 years of his life in a deceitful manner with his brother. You see? And yet he struggled with God. God brought him to that point, and with the angel, and, you know, as we read here in Genesis, with the man. And he wept. Well, in verse 4 again. Yes, he struggled with the angel and prevailed. You see? And so that's what he's, in essence, message is giving to Ephraim. You did not prevail. You know, you gave up. You went up. You know, you went after the east wind. You went after nothing. And then look at your father, and you should go back, you know. That's what repentance is, you know, return. Go back to God and be like your father, you know. Struggle with God and prevail. And so he says, you know, and he struggled with the angel, verse 4, and he prevailed and wept, who sought favor from him. You see, so he cried to God. He wept before God. Help me. Deliver me. You see? And that's a part of the struggle with God. And not bringing an accusation against him. You know, what's wrong with you? Why didn't you help me and all that, you know? Well, you know, why did Johnny die, you know? And people are getting bitter and angry and all that. Now, this is not the spirit of Jacob. You see? The spirit of Jacob is recognizing who God is and recognizing the fact that we are not really worth anything anyway. And it's all by the grace of God. And then we wrestle with God, you know, with the right attitude. And then, if we do all these things, obviously God is going to give us the strength and we're going to prevail. You see? And God will deliver us. That's in essence a capitalized form of the entirety of the process of conversion. And here it is, in essence, happening in one day. But obviously, that's the entirety of the life that Jacob had to live until the end of his days. And I had to endure until the end. Not from Israel, go back again to a supplanter. And unfortunately, much of Jacob went back to becoming a supplanter, you know, deceitful people, and they are still to this very day. And obviously, we should come out of this state of mind, which is, again, the Babylonian state of mind. And so that's what we read here. And God wants us to overcome that. And so in verse 4 we continue. You know, Jacob weeps before God and he sought favor from him and he found him in Bethel. You know, that's where he struggled with him. And there he spoke to us. You know, this is God spoke to us through Jacob. That is the Lord God of hosts. The Eternal, that is Jehovah, is his memorable name. You see? That was his name. Jehovah, the Eternal. That's what Jacob was asking. Tell me your name. You see, show me your power in essence. He's not asking, you know, in other words, the language, tell me your name, this is not what it means. You see, you have to know beyond, you have to go deeply beyond that to understand what he's talking about. Show me your glory, show me your strength. That's what he's saying. You see? And then, when you go to, you know, you go forward into the history of Moses, when he appears before God, you know, he had the same question there also. You know, firstly, when he appeared before him in the burning bush, you know, he wanted to know also about the name of God, and we shall come to that. And so we continue here with Jacob in Genesis 32 and verse 29. Actually, in verse 30, where Jacob in is asking, tell me, I pray, your name. And he said, that is, God replies, where is it that you do ask after my name? And he blessed him there. You see? And verse 31, and Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, the face of God, for I have seen, he said, God face to face, and my life is preserved. Not only at that point, you see, but for the future also, and deliverance from Esau and so forth. So, you know, an awful lot goes into that. And, you know, some people that think that the law is a boring book to go through, obviously they're ignorant people. And they are not the kind of people that wrestle with God. That's why they, you know, they're in their ignorance, and the ignorance they've been raised with, they say, well, I just want to read the New Testament. You know, this is where I get inspired. The Old Testament is just old stuff. It's not for us. All done away with. Well, these are not Israelites. You see? I mean, there may be Israelites physically speaking, but that's meaningless. As far as that is concerned, God said, you know, you're not different. You know, he said in, I believe in Amos, speaking to his people, he said, you're not different to me than the Ethiopians. You know, you're not better than they are. You see, people of Ethiopia, physically speaking. But, you know, if you become spiritual Israelites, well, that's a difference. And, you know, and the Apostle Paul put it in a different way. You know, it's not, you know, he's not a Jew who is, you know, outwardly, you know, that's just physical, that's meaningless. So what? You see, you know, you're not different than Ethiopian or Chinese or anybody else. But the Jew who is inwardly. Well, anyway, we're going to stop at this point. This is again Mordecai Joseph saying greetings to all of God's people.